Hi there, this is Yarrow, and welcome to Vested Capital episode number 24, featuring my guest, Collis Taid, the co-founder of Invato. Vested Capital is a podcast about how people make money and put their capital to work. I interview startup founders, angel investors, venture capitalists, crypto and stock traders, real estate investors, and leaders in technology. Today, I'm actually re-releasing an episode I released only to members of a membership site. Now, like a couple of previous episodes, I've released episodes that were on my old podcast and also in my membership site. The most recent one was a Tim Ferriss trilogy. You can go back a few episodes to have a listen to that. One of the episodes in that special trilogy episode I released was an episode with Tim, an interview I recorded only for members of a community I run called the Laptop Lifestyle Academy. The one I'm going to share with you today with Collis Taid is also one of those exclusive interviews, I called them. I actually sold this as a standalone subscription product so many years ago now, probably a decade ago, back when I was very much focused on selling education products, teaching products, and was my first ever subscription site, pure subscription site, where I was basically releasing two episodes or two interviews with experts every month and also included a breakdown of what I thought were their leverage points, these reports I wrote to go with them. So Collis was invited to be one of my guest experts on that series, primarily because he had experience huge success with some marketplaces he had created. So this is a really interesting interview. Of course, like I've done in previous times, I've re-listened to this. It is a little old. We recorded this, I think, 2012, 2013. Amazingly enough, the company that he grew, Invato, it's kind of like the umbrella brand for all the websites and marketplaces and blogs and things under it. It was already super successful back when I recorded this interview with Collis, and we covered pretty much the growth from absolutely nothing to the point where they had 100 staff. I think they were doing well over $1 million a month at that point in sales across the entire marketplace. So it was at least a multiple seven figures business, maybe eight figures at the time. And what makes this especially exciting for me to share with you was, okay, fast forward many, many years forward from that first interview with him. I'm maybe 2 or 3 years ago, probably about that, I am reading up on what is commonly released in Australia, like the rich list, which, you know, we have in the States as well, and probably have in every country that releases some kind of like Forbes or Entrepreneur or whatever, most successful, the billionaires. And in this case, it was the Australian tech billionaire, maybe not even tech, I think it was tech, the tech billionaire list in like a top 10 richest people. And I'm scrolling down and I'm seeing, you know, the founders of Atlassian, and then I'm seeing, I think Canva, Melanie and her two co-founders were there, Melanie Perkins. And then as I hit to like number 8 or 9, I see Collis and his wife, Sayan Taid, listed amongst this top 10 in all of Australia. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how big did Invato Group become? How big do they get? Well, just as I record this, they've had their $1 billionth in return of revenue to their community. So basically, just to clarify exactly what all this is, Invato is an umbrella company name for a series of marketplaces that Collis and his team released over many years. So obviously, you'll hear the start of that in this interview. One of the most famous ones is Theme Forest, which is WordPress themes. Audio Jungle is another one. That's the one I've actually used. Some of my very early podcast episodes had intro music and outro music. I got that music from Audio Jungle, which is Collis's site. There's a few other early ones like Flash Den, later changed to Active Den, which was a marketplace for Flash design files. There was PSD Toots, another kind of Photoshop design site. And, you know, since then, it's become like this marketplace for all kinds of video, audio, and WordPress themes and graphic design. And when I say marketplace, creators come to the site, they list their design files for sale, then people come to the site, search for files, buy whatever they need. Most of the money goes back to the creator, but Invato, and obviously Collis's company, takes a slice of that transaction. So it's a true marketplace for digital media. And Collis and his wife and team just rode the wave of the internet unlocking these global sized marketplaces to the tune of, I'm not exactly sure of the numbers, because amazingly enough, the entire time Collis was growing this company, it was bootstrapped. Never raised funding, never did an IPO. It was very deliberate. I did a bit of research before releasing this to you guys because I wanted to make sure I knew as much as I could about the current state of Envato. Can't quote me on this. I can't 100% verify it because it is a private company. So they don't release these numbers, but they have about 600 employees now based in Melbourne, Mexico, and LA. They do about $300 million a year in revenue. And it's an amazing success story, obviously. You can't technically call it a unicorn, and you can't even technically call Colas a billionaire. Although by all metrics that I know of as an angel investor, it is definitely a unicorn, and they are definitely billionaires because I'm assuming they own 100% of the company across the, you know, the family ownership of Envato. So this is a unicorn story. This is a billion-dollar founder story. And what I'm especially excited to give you this today is it covers the first growth to 100 employees. So from the point of this interview onwards, they 6x'd that. They grew to 600 employees and probably, you know, more than 6x their revenue. But we hear from zero, literally going into $100,000 in debt in the story, and how they started their first marketplaces, you know, how they got their first customers, and why do they invest so much money? They actually moved in with Zion's parents for the first year or two. It's a real traditional, you know, working in your garage, putting in sweat equity and every single penny you can make, no venture capital, no investors besides, you know, family sweat equity. So impressive story. And I'm really excited to share it with you. In fact, we even go earlier than that story because I know Colas from his days as a blogger, which very much connects to what he does with the marketplaces at Envato. Colas and I, through the blogging space that we were both in around sort of 2006, 7, 8, we connected. We met at an event. I think we were both speakers at Darren Rouse's Pro Blogger event. I don't know how many years ago that was, 2009 maybe. And he was running a blog called Freelance Switch. Before that, he also had a network that I think it was part of called North by East. So I found him through those two blogs, connected with him as a fellow Aussie. For those who don't know, I actually grew up in Brisbane, Australia. You can listen to Vested Capital Episode 0 to hear that story. And we just hit it off as most bloggers do and shared stories and talked about producing content and growing audiences and things like that. And we kept in touch. And then I saw him kind of switch gears into these marketplaces. And I was like, that's a smart thing to do. And clearly it was because it went on to make him a billionaire. Today, Colas and his wife actually live in Darwin, Australia. And he stepped down as CEO of Envato Group 2 years ago, I think it was, maybe a year and a half ago, depending on when you're listening to this. And he's kind of focusing on, looks like, investing and charity-based work. So that's great. And Envato continues to grow and is now being run by a CEO. And he's lived the full life cycle from startup, hustling, bootstrapping, and clearly exiting at the top. So an amazing story. And so excited to release this interview with you because, frankly, it's never been heard by the public before. Only my few members have listened to it. And it's probably one of the only audio interviews Colas did during that time frame. He wasn't the most prolific on podcast kind of guy. And I'm really glad that he got to share the origin story of these marketplaces because, you know, that is really the sweet spot. It obviously grew from the point where we finished this recording. Okay, that is a super huge long intro to this one. Like I said, it is a re-release of something I only had for my members. Please share it. Obviously, if you find this useful, we'd love for you to share it with anyone who you think would benefit from hearing about this story. And don't forget to subscribe to Vested Capital. Click the plus, the subscribe, the follow button. Get this podcast on your apps. My gosh, I have some amazing guests coming up. I've had some amazing guests already in the past in the previous 23-ish episodes we've done so far just this year, not to mention the 50 plus of my best episodes I put on the feed. If you subscribe, that's the best way to get them. And yeah, I can't wait to hear your feedback on this one. So press play. I'll press play on the interview right now. Love to hear your feedback. Twitter is the best way. Just send a message at Yaro Starek or just hashtag Vested Capital after you listen to this one. Share it on Twitter too. I'd really appreciate that. Okay, enough for me. Here's the interview with Colas Taid, the co-founder of Envato. Before I sort of jump back in time, can you just tell me, like, how big is this business? Can you sort of highlight what it is, how many people you employ, how much money you make, all those sorts of things?
Yeah, sure. I can give a bit of overview. So we're at the moment, we have a little over 100 staff, I think like 120 or so, most of whom are in here in Melbourne in Australia, and then a good portion are also just working remote from different locations around the world, depending on what their tasks are and whatnot. The network as a whole has about 1 million visits a day. So a million visitors a day to all the various properties. So that's our marketplaces, our tutorial sites, our App Store network, everything all combined. And our marketplaces are selling an item every 10 seconds. It's a little more than that, actually. So in terms of volume, there's a lot of throughput these days. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are those 120 employees like employees, or is that a mix of contractors, employees?
Mix of contractors and employees. So that's like editors and things, editors, reviewers. So every item that's on our marketplaces gets reviewed by our review team. So they are a team of 35, I think, and they're all around the world. Then there's lots of developers and whatnot who've been here in the headquarter office.
So how many people are with you in the office on a day-to-day basis?
60.
Okay. So it's it's not a one-man show anymore, or a husband and wife team.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, sorry. Yeah,
that's all right.
Need to edit that bit out.
Oh, no. We're very natural here. So let's go back in time to that start. Was it actually just a husband and wife team to begin with all this?
So at the very beginning, myself and my wife, Cyan, we together wanted to start a business. My best friend, Jin, had also been talking to me for ages about, hey, we should do something together. So we roped him in. Initially, he was more of an investor. He put it in basically a bit of his savings, and then gradually started taking over things like support and whatnot once we'd actually launched. So Cyan and I did a lot of the early building work. We hired a contract developer. So from the very beginning, there was a few people. One of the benefits of having co-founders is you have some cheap labor sources early on. So my wife Cyan and Jin, we did have a single contract staffer. About a year in, we managed to rope my brother in as well. So it quickly started to become a bit of a family business.
Was it your first business? What was the day for this to begin with?
So this is back in 2006. Actually, a year and a half before that, Sam and I had been freelancing together. So that was technically our first business. We'd even had an employee at one point during our freelancing. We weren't very good at it, though, I have to admit, overall. And it was the source of many articles on Freelance Switch, though, all the various mistakes and things we've learned along the way freelancing. So by the beginning of 2006, we decided to start an online business. Cyan wanted to travel. It was one of the early reasons we were doing it. Okay. We wanted to travel, and I was like, yeah, we'll totally have a business we can do from our laptops anywhere in the world. That'll work.
So freelancing was it. So were you two working jobs? Like, I want to go even further back, I guess, Collis. Like, from the very start here, were you an entrepreneur, or did you get a degree and then get a job and do that sort of path?
Well, I got a degree in math, and then I got a job in a cafe.
That makes sense.
Not sure if that's where all math graduates go. That's where I went. Became a barista making coffee, and then decided I really wanted to do web design. Jin, my best friend, was a web designer, and so he taught me some of the basics, and I learned a lot online from tutorials and things. I managed to score a job at a very small little... Well, it was me and my boss, basically. It was a two-man agency doing web design. And then I got one other job for another year. And then I decided to start freelancing. I enjoyed working for people. But ultimately, I wanted to be my own boss, be an entrepreneur. Then got into freelancing with Cyan, and then from freelancing into Envato.
When did you meet Cyan?
Oh, she better not listen to this. I can't remember. I think.
Uh-oh.
Of course, I memorized my anniversary date, I'm sure. It would be about 10 years. So I'm going to say 2002.
You remember how you met then, I assume.
Yes, I remember how. That was at a design meetup here in Australia. We have the Australian Graphic Designers Association, and they were starting a little student body. Once I got my first job as a web designer, I'd taken a night course in interactive multimedia. So I went and joined the student body, partially to meet women. And said I need
right on.
Worked. I met Cyan, so that was good.
Okay, so because Cyan's a big part of what you do. You're a two-man team, aren't you, sort of from the beginning?
Yeah, that's right. I would say both Cyan and I, but also Jin and my brother Vahid, and these days my father as well, the five of us together, at family get-togethers, it's pretty bad. The five of us just end up...
business, right?
The core of it, I guess, Cyan and myself.
Okay. So let's jump into how this all started. So you were freelancing. You said you weren't good at it. So I assume you were just doing website design and that sort of work for people.
Yeah, we did everything from graphic to web to branding. We did a lot of different types of clients. So we did some local government, we did some small business, we did some multinational business, we did all sorts of things. The reason I say we weren't very good at it was that we worked insane hours. I think we tended to undercharge most of the time. It was really stressful. I used to work all the weekends. It wasn't that we weren't getting work. So it wasn't that kind of not good at it. It was the kind of not good where it's not a very healthy lifestyle and or profitable business, if that makes sense.
Right.
A different type of not good.
So was that what stimulated the desire to have a different type of business?
Yeah, I think we really wanted to get away from client work. We were doing a lot of last minute jobs, a lot of deadlines, a lot of jobs which had gone wrong and which became not very profitable at the end. Yeah, it was a bit of a stressful business. And as I say, Sam wanted to travel and we felt really locked down to Sydney. We used to live in Sydney back then because that's where our clients were. So we had this idea that we could start an online business, which we could do from a laptop anywhere in the world. And it would be a marketplace and, you know, we wouldn't have clients we'd need to go visit or anything like that. And it would be this new holy grail business. We did eventually travel for a year, but during that time, the business grew so much that we had to come home. So it didn't quite pan out the way we thought.
Right.
So it still panned out well. So it shouldn't sound like nothing to complain about.
It does sound like you've never had a problem with, I guess, the acquisition of clients and being busy with work. It's the type of work you've wanted to do has been the problem.
Yeah, that's true. And the volume.
Okay. I'd love to even spend a bunch of time talking about how you got clients back in the day, Collis, but probably we don't have time. I really want to get onto the Envato group because there's obviously a lot of different websites there. So when you guys decided it's time to switch, good choice of words there. What was the first project you were thinking of starting and then that you brought these partners on?
Yeah. Brother? So at that time, even while we were freelancing, I used to sell stuff online. I guess I was interested in passive income and other ways to make money other than client work. So I used to sell flash mostly on a marketplace called iStockPhoto, which is obviously famous for photos. But even to this day, I believe they still have a flash category somewhere in there. It wasn't a really good way to sell flash, to be honest. The site was all geared towards photographers. But even so, there were sales. At that time, I knew that you could sell flash. I knew there was a way to sell it, but it wasn't a good way for selling flash. I'd had some experience and had made some flash files that were worth selling. We kind of decided, well, why don't we make the equivalent sort of marketplace, but everything would be geared towards selling flash. And it would be a flash marketplace and the forums would all be about flash instead of about photography. And the previews would be geared towards flash and, you know, so on and so forth. And so that was the site we launched with. It took us 6 months to construct, which was a lot longer than I'd expected. We hired this contract developer, Ryan, who eventually became our first employee. He and I used to do the front-end work and design, and he did the back-end coding. And we built what, in retrospect, if I looked back at it now, it was probably a bit of a ghetto website. But at the time, I was like, this is amazing. It's got every feature you can imagine. But now I look back and think, oh, wow, okay, it was a quick-to-market sort of site, I suppose. And so we got that out in August 2006.
And did it work?
It worked. Well, it had a single sale on the first day of $10. And at the time, I was very depressed about that. I'm not sure if everyone else has this experience, but for me, when you're building something, like building a product, I think you have it in your head that the world is going to be so super duper excited when you launch it that they'll all just be queuing up to use it. Of course, the reality is you have to do a lot of hard work to market a website. And actually, in retrospect, the fact we had a sale on the first day is amazing.
I know. I was going to say, like, where did that person find you? How did they?
I know. And looking back, it is quite staggering. What we did on day one, the reason we had some traffic was we used design galleries. They used to be design galleries both for, I guess they still are, for general websites, but also for flash websites. We were mostly, because it wasn't, although it was a marketplace for flash, it wasn't a flash website. So this was mostly traffic from other general design galleries, which was very targeted for this particular product because it's a product for kind of web designers. So getting an audience of web designers from a web design gallery made a lot of sense. It doesn't make sense for every business, obviously, but it did for that one. And the design, I guess, was good enough to get into a few different galleries, and we immediately started getting traffic. And obviously one person. I should really look up who that person was, actually. One person gave us our first $10 sale.
Yeah, yeah. Customer appreciation award right there. So, you know, you had five people already working here. One sale doesn't cover the cost. How is this all going to work?
Yeah, so we had put in our savings, basically. So Cyan, myself, and Jun, we'd all put in our savings. We basically kept doing freelance work for about a year and a half. We didn't actually take a salary for almost 2 years, I think. We'd count our hours so that we could get the company to pay us eventually, back pay us, but we didn't actually take any money. We just kept freelancing, used up all our savings, used up our credit cards, moved in with Cyan's parents, borrowed money from my parents. It was a little bit stressful, actually.
It sounds like a gamble, too. Like, that's a lot. Well, it sounds like a lot of money. I don't know if you remember sort of the vicinity of how much went into something like that.
It was, I think, in total, we came to close to $100,000 by the time we'd gotten some months into actual operations. We'd spent, a little over $100,000.
That's huge. What if it didn't work? Like,
that's right. Yeah, it's funny now, you know, looking at the company, it feels like, well, you know, of course it was a good idea. But at that time, it was pretty damn stressful. I definitely recall that period of my life as being one of the more stressful times of my life. I used to spend a lot of time worrying about money. And there was a period just before we launched the marketplace where I didn't actually think we were going to manage to finish the site. The build had been dragging on for a while. Some stuff wasn't working, and I was like, oh crap, I screwed up. We really blew this. We should have stuck to freelancing. But then we managed to get the site out. Some sales came in. By December of that year, we could see there was just enough sales to know that they were kind of onto something. I think the fact that we had had experience actually selling Flash before was a good sign. It wasn't a made-up idea, if that makes sense. Like, it was something none of us had any experience with. It was actually something we had tested the market for in a way. So I think that was probably one source of reassurance. But yes, at the time, it was scary.
I mean, nowadays, no one would suggest, go spend $100,000, build a website, and it'll be okay. They'll say, no, test a small website, a few $100s, and, you know, build from that.
Yeah, that's very true.
What was wrong with you, Carlos? That's all I can say. Like, what a gamble in a lot of ways. But hey, you know, it worked. So maybe you can keep moving us forward through the process. So what happened next?
So we launched the website, and then I guess the next few months was a big process of improving the site and marketing. So we were still spending some of that $100,000 after we built the website. So some of that was content production. Because, you know, with a marketplace, you need stuff to sell. Can't just have an empty marketplace. Marketplaces have that real classic chicken and egg problem. All kinds of marketplaces, whether it's a job board or classifieds or whatever it is, you need stuff to sell and people to buy, and neither is interested in it unless the other one's there. So the way we addressed the problem was we seeded the market with content. Some of it was stuff I'd made, but we also commissioned a bunch of content. Some of that went into the early days, and then a lot of the effort was into marketing. A lot of our time was spent building our user base. And we did that in a ton of different ways. So we pretty much tried every single thing we could possibly think of. We didn't have much money. We did spend a little bit of money on advertising, but we weren't a venture-funded company or anything like that. So that was pretty limited advertising. I mentioned design galleries. That was a good source of early traffic. We used to go into forums a lot and talk to people, like just individual people, convincing people to come and sell in our marketplace. We did lots of giveaways and things like that. A few months in, I started getting into blogging as a way to, I guess, start building traffic, but also just even do things like run competitions and stuff. I wanted to have this section of our website where we would run competitions and things like that. And our developer, who was Ryan, who was like overworked, was like, no, I refuse to build this. Just go get a blog. There's this thing called WordPress. Go try it out. And the best thing he ever said to me, because that was the start of a long blogging WordPress infatuation, which took me to all sorts of places. But yeah, so blogging was one of the kind of early, I guess, ways we built some audience. Email marketing, lots of networking with other people in the industry. Yeah, all kinds of things. My, I guess, philosophy on marketing is really that you just have to try every single thing you can think of and sort of optimize. That you can't, there's no one magic bullet. There's no one solution, one size fits all kind of solution. You just kind of have to try things, especially when you have no money. I suppose when you have lots of money, you could just throw it at some advertising or something. I've never tried that approach.
So when did it reach a point where you were cash flow neutral, where you could actually cover everyone's salaries and, you know, had a business that was functioning?
Cash flow neutral. We launched in August. In November, we did one massive promotion where we gave away $10,000 of credits. So there goes another portion of that seed money. And that brought in a lot more traffic. So by December, so this is only like 3 or 4 months in, and we were doing about $1,000 a week in sales, which was quite amazing, actually. Now I look back, $1,000 a week, that's not cash flow neutral, obviously, though, for 4 people working on a site. Yeah. But it was enough to go, well, in 4 months, we could get to $1,000 a week. That's a pretty good sign. The subsequent year, revenue jumped by 20-fold. So by the end of the year, we'd gotten to $20,000 a week. So that was the end of 2007, which was a big milestone for us, because $20,000 a week is about $1 million a year. I remember feeling like this was unbelievable. And you have to remember, though, our business, the marketplace, portion of every sale goes to the author of the item. So this is gross revenue. At that point, we were still not cash flow neutral. More or less for a good 2 years, I would say, every time we made inroads into how much sales we had, we would just invest it all back into the business. It was close to 2 years before we paid ourselves salary. So I would say about the 2 year mark, I would classify as neutral. Right. Wow.
So 2 years of living with your parents and eating noodles for dinner. Is that?
It was pretty bad. We didn't stay with my in-laws for the whole 2 years, thank goodness. About 6 months in, we managed to get it together to move into a little apartment. But that was a lot of noodle eating there for a while.
Dedication. So when did this start to explode into the stupid number of websites you had? Like, did the blogging thing then turn to freelance switch, or was that still?
Yes, I had a blog called North by East.
Remember that one?
So yeah, that's right. That was right at the beginning where I used to give advice about blogging and business, which was really the stupidest thing because I'd only just gotten into both of those things. I don't know that I had very much value to add in either domain, but in any case, I used my little soapbox and I built a very small audience. I think I managed to get to 400 RSS readers during that time. It was over a course of about 3 months. And that was hard work. I think that was probably the hardest readership I've ever had to build. From that, I had a single post on that site, which was about freelancing. And it was the first post that had some social media traction. So back then, it was the site delicious.com, which is, I don't know, is Delicious even still running, I think? Maybe it was taken down.
I think it is, but there was
listeners who don't remember the website that was really awesome and could send quite a lot of traffic if you got onto the popular page. And this post made it on the popular page. So that weekend, I came up with the idea that we should have a whole blog dedicated to freelancing, because I was a web designer. I designed it and built it more or less that weekend. By like the Tuesday, I think we launched it. And it immediately hit lots of traffic. I guess it was the fact that that post made it to the popular page was an indication that there was an interested market in freelancing. Once we launched the site, it got a lot more social media traction as well. It very quickly got the same amount of traffic it roughly has today, years later. It's been very stable. It was a weird site in the sense that it grew very quick and then it stayed stable for years.
Mine's been a bit like that too, actually.
Oh, it's like I don't know. Does that mean it's saturated the market? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I do find interesting your idea there where, you know, you start a blog on something, one article happens to go really well, and then you go, you know what? Let's do a new blog, focus only on this niche that this article did well. And that worked because, you know, you could have just kept writing about the same chapter on the existing blog, but you decided, no, let's change the branding, let's change the message. And that's probably a smart thing to do.
Well, I don't know. It's a good point, actually. It didn't even occur to me that I could have kept going on the first blog. There's some decisions that you will find sound like wise decisions, but did not occur to me that I should have done something different. Yeah, I mean, the benefit of going to freelance, which was it was a targeted brand. The whole site was built around the idea of freelancing. I did research the niche a little bit after that post and discovered there was one other blog which is dedicated to freelancing that this woman started, and she'd written a few good posts and then totally dropped off and hadn't kept it up, which is so unfortunate because like her posts were good and obviously the niche was interesting. And I think that's one of those classic blogging advice pieces of, you know, it's a marathon. But at the end of the day, a lot of people just don't keep going, I guess.
Now, what was the plan here? Because you were doing a marketplace for flash sort of buying and selling, basically.
Yeah,
Well, it makes sense to me to start a freelance blog as a marketing tool because you're bringing in people who might create Flash and also want to buy Flash for their own products they do for client work. So it is a good synergy there. But were you looking, maybe you made this up as you went along, Carlos, I don't know, but were you thinking Freelance Switch as a vehicle for bringing in customers for your Flash site, which, by the way, what was the name of it?
It was called Flash Den back then, eventually Adobe made us change the name. So it's now called Active Den.
Okay, Active Den.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds very sensible. Let's go with that reason.
Carlos, one of the things I love about the way you do business is you sort of build stuff because you want to, and it seems to work more often than not. So I want to keep going with your story, but since I've just said that, why do you think it works? Like, what are you doing right in each of these cases as we go through them all?
The reason we built Freelance Switch was really purely just because I thought it was interesting to do. I think the reason it's worked for us has been that I usually look for things that I think are interesting, which means that I guess I would have some knowledge of the space. So I don't really believe in trying to build a business in something you don't know anything about. That's a bit dangerous. And it sounds silly, but lots of people do it. Like, I hear there's a lot of money on the internet. I better go make an internet business. Mm. It's not such a crazy thing to say.
But most fail. And you seem to work. You make it work over and over again.
Yeah. So I think having an interest means that you know a bit about that area. So I think that's the first thing. And the other thing, I guess, is looking for trends and looking for signs that there's a market or some growth. So with Flash Den, as I said before, I'd actually sold Flash before. So I had some inkling that there was a market. With Freelance Switch, I'd had a post that had been really successful. So I guess I knew there was some interest in freelancing. And I did a survey of the market before starting the site. Later, the next site we started was PSD Tuts, which is a Photoshop tutorial site. And with that one, I guess I knew a lot about Photoshop. And before we actually made it a full-blown blog about Photoshop, it was first just a little collection of tutorials, like just HTML tutorials on a single domain. So there wasn't a lot to it. And a couple of those tutorials, two of the first four we put up, made it to the Dig homepage. So I guess once again, it was like, well, there's obviously a market here. Let's do more.
Mm. Now, I remember watching you because I was following you from the North by East days when, you did your first blog and then Freelance Switch. And I remember, I guess it wasn't a Flash Den because I wasn't interested in Flash so much. But one thing I noticed about you was your incredible ability to launch projects when you already have a huge work plate. Like, you were writing one blog, then you sort of realized, you know what? This is not going to work because I can't write for a freelance blog as well as run the business. And then you're opening up PSD Toots and it's another marketplace. So you have a great strategy for growth, or at least you seem to have executed one where you bring in people at the right time and you find good A players. Like, how have you managed growth so well?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is realizing that you have to not try to do everything yourself. Like, I think that is one area that's surprisingly easy to get stuck on, feeling like, well, it needs to be me. So I used to review all the files on Flashden when I first started, for example. And I resisted getting a reviewer for ages because I was like, nobody can review files quite the way that I do, which is total crap. People can review them way better than I could have ever done. And eventually, I was forced to do it because I was so excited about doing other things. Like, I really wanted to start blogging, and I really wanted to do later on Freelance Switch, and later on I really wanted to do whatever it was that I really wanted to do. I guess forced my hand to delegate. Like, there was just no way you could do everything, so it was always like, damn it, I have to give this to somebody else. And then I suppose in terms of finding people, it was a bit hit and miss. Sometimes we'd get people who worked out really well, not always. Each time you learn a bit more. So we've had some editors and freelancers and employees and whatnot who are better than others. I think we've been blessed to have a lot of good people. I wouldn't say it was 100% success rate or anything like that.
How do you find them?
A mix of things. So for contractors and freelancers, we often use the sites themselves. So for Freelance Switch, I think we found our first editor, or probably all of our editors, through the site. So people who are either, typically with our blogs, we would get people to write for the blog. So we'd put a little ad on the side saying, if you want to write for this site, we pay whatever it is. I think when we first started the site, it was $60 an article we would pay. And then we would pick someone who seemed like a very organized writer and then asked them if they could do more editing work. And then if they were doing well at that, maybe they could become the editor. So sourcing through the community is a good way to do it. We also just post job ads. There's obviously lots of online job boards. There's localized ones here in Australia. There's Seek. That's, I guess, for more full-time employees. But yeah, I find going through the site to be quite a good way of finding people who already understand what you're doing and understand your content. So like for a blog, when you want to get another editor, you really want them to understand the site and like the voice of the site. So having someone who's already a reader really helps rather than someone who's coming in cold and just trying to emulate you from reading a few posts.
Now, I could not afford to pay $60 an hour, an article from a writer. Is there like a cash cow that you had that was sort of keeping all this growth working, a sort of stable? Was it the Flash Den or Active Den?
Yeah, so Active Den, by that point, by the time we launched Freelancer, it should be about April 2007, it would have gone for, it been going for maybe 8 months, and it had enough income that we could use that income to fund Freelancer. Plus, a lot of the early writing was actually me and Cyan. I even made some pseudonyms for myself so we would look like we had a bigger writing team.
That's interesting because most people like having a personal brand, like one or two people, you know, behind it. You deliberately try to make yourselves look bigger. Is that?
Yeah, I guess I wanted us to look like a real magazine and to attract other writers. And to attract other writers, I was like, well, you know, they won't want to just see the same old name popping up. So I'll make up some pseudonyms.
That's interesting. Very counterintuitive to this sort of traditional.
Yeah, it is actually, now that you say.
Yeah, but I can see where your thinking is behind that. You're looking company. You're not thinking personal brand. You're thinking company. So that's an attitude there.
That's true. And I was always scared to tie our sites too much to... I'm generally even scared to tie the company too much to me because it means that it's harder to replace yourself in the sense that, you know, with a blog, the readers expect to hear... Like, you know, if you go to carlostaib.com and that was a blog, you'd expect to see Carlos Taib posting. I couldn't go off and do something else. So you're kind of stuck to it. So I suppose in that sense, having a writing team seemed like a natural thing to do in order to keep yourself free.
Right. And I'm in the same situation. Writing is my thing and they expect it from Yarrow. So, you know, it's a great point. Like, you know, horses for courses. You wanted to build a company and continue to get really large. So, and I've sort of stepped in that direction, but realized that, no, I like the simplicity of a small operation. So yeah. I think like I could never work as hard as you do, Carlos, to be absolutely truthful.
I think also for me, it's partially wanting it to be large, but also partially just I get bored really easily and I want to start something else. Like I have this analogy I like to use, which is when I was young, I used to like baking cakes, but my mum wouldn't allow me to bake cakes unless I washed up after myself. And I always think that like I'm not allowed to start new sites unless I have a system for running the old site already. Mm. That's like the cleanup after it. So and early on, I guess I realized this. And so by the time we were launching Freelance Switch, it was because we'd built a system to keep running the other one. Unfortunately, this leads to having a large company.
But you know what? Take us through that, Carlos. So you set up Active Den to run itself. You set up Freelance Switch to run itself. You set up PSD to run itself. Is that how this progressed? And where are we at? 2008, 2009?
That's right. So, and with each one, I guess the other aspect we touched on earlier about like delegating and whatnot. And the other aspect I think to it is to have a very organized understanding of what it takes to run a particular site. So very early on, we would codify things. So when we wanted to find our first reviewer for Flash Den, we had to codify, like write out in detail what it takes to review and essentially make a manual of this is how you review files. And I would do that since I and our team, I guess, would do that for all the different roles we had. So when it was editing a blog, I would do it for a while and then I'd write a manual of what I'd been doing and find someone to kind of run the site off that manual. And of course, those people would inevitably improve the process and the system and improve the manual. So today, for example, for all our Tuts Network, we have a manual for what it takes to edit a particular blog and similarly for reviewing and whatnot. And so that you try to take the person out a little bit and it becomes more systematic, a systematic way of doing things. And so we, I guess, did that all along the way and introduced roles like site managers for the marketplaces. I can't even remember when it was. I think around 2008, decided we need a site manager for each marketplace. By 2008, I think we'd launched Audio Jungle, which was the second marketplace. Those first 2 years, Ryan, and then later on, we hired another couple of developers. We're working very hard to take the system we'd built, which was for a single marketplace, and turn that application into an app that could generate multiple marketplaces, which is what we have today. So there's a single application. It runs, I think, 9 marketplaces now. They're just spread over different domains, but it's actually the same marketplace engine. But yeah, and so for each marketplace, we needed a site manager, and each site manager had a manual about how to run a review team and how to manage the forums and how to do this and that. And they would all talk to each other, and there's systems for how to invoice us and how to do this and how to do that. And so I think if you want to grow a business and grow a staff to run that business, it helps to have this very systematic way of thinking about jobs and tasks and breaking them down and trying to codify them so that someone else can come in and switch in.
How, because like you're talking about what I think is one of the most boring things for a creative to do, which is systems. And it sounds like you did both. You were creative in a writing capacity, in a design capacity, in a flash capacity. And then you're going down writing systems. Like, how do you manage to find everything? I know you're not interesting, but you manage to do it all.
Yeah, I don't know if I find everything interesting, but I guess so. I love work, right? Like, I suspect that comes across, but if in case it doesn't, I enjoy working, but I don't classify all work as the same. For me, there's like fun work, and then there's like work where you really just have to do it. And for me, I'm always trying my best to make more time so I can do fun work, which is thinking up new ideas, doing creative work, planning new websites, launching new things. But in order to do that, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I guess I've sort of just realized this. Unless I do the bit that I don't really like, I don't get to do the bit that I do like. So I just force myself, I guess, is the it's mildly depressing sounding.
Well, yeah, perhaps the reality for all entrepreneurs. There are parts you have to force yourself to do. So can you maybe just fill the gaps to bring this up today? What websites do you have, and what do you spend personal time now on? Like, what are you doing right now?
As the company grew, I guess every year for me, so I'm the CEO of Envato, yeah, and every year that job changes in my mind. Early on, it was, I guess I was an entrepreneur, really starting a business. These days, it's much more running a company. One of the lessons I've had over the years is realizing that running a company and starting a business have nothing to do with each other. They're really quite different. And so each year that role has changed. Early on, it was a very product-driven role, thinking up products, launching them, very marketing role as well. So I would spend a lot of time doing marketing. Around the sort of 2009, 2010, 2011 period, I was starting to learn more about management and business, I suppose, building teams, how to manage teams. We started our Melbourne office in, I think it was 2009. So there's things like office culture, a work environment, all that kind of stuff. And finance, had to go do some finance courses so I could teach myself what a balance sheet is and how to read a profit and loss statement and stuff like that. But then today, with the team growing to the size it is, I spend a lot of my time on things like PR, communications with the team, meetings, lots and lots and lots of meetings. So most of my days are just meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, which is a little bit scary. it's not what I'd imagined I would be doing, but at the same time, there's good and bad to it. So the bad is obviously I have meeting after meeting after meeting. The good to it is that you get to meet with all these interesting people and your company doing interesting stuff and hear about all the different parts and put in your 2 cents and think about things, and they do stuff you've never thought of doing. And so in that sense, it's really amazing. But there is some little parts of me that kind of wishes I could go back to doing the design work, doing the front end work, the grassroots marketing and stuff. But it's changed a lot.
And how long are your days? Are you doing normal 9 to 5? Or?
No, I don't think you ever get to do normal 9 to 5. But I don't do too bad. In the early days, I used to work very hard. When during that period where we had no money and a lot of debt, would work months and months without a day off of long 10, 12-hour days. These days, I work a good solid work week of sort of 10-hour days every day. The weekends will have what I classify as fun work, which is that I usually on my weekends, I spend a few hours here and there thinking about things and planning for the future and whatnot. I have a 20-month-old son, so that kind of wipes out a lot of your chance to just work like a crazy person.
Right, yes. So what is the sort of future thinking here? Do you want to do that, this sort of lifestyle forever? Are you hoping to sell out one day and switch completely and sort of, you know, relax and have big amount of money in your bank account? Like, what are you thinking?
I think for me, it's been years now, and I guess I've always thought this way, but I just concentrate on how the company is growing. There's been new challenges every year. So at the moment, I still feel like I'm constantly pushed. I think if I was constantly doing the same thing, I'd start thinking about like, okay, how do we get out and how do I go do something else? But every year my job changes, right? Like every year I'm doing new types of things. There's new challenges. The company's grown. I think in the last year we've doubled the staff size. So it's just like a whole raft of new things to deal with. So in that sense, my focus is really about where the company's going and how we're growing our mission. So our mission is to help people learn and earn, which is the learning side comes from our tutorial network, Tuts, and the earning side from our marketplaces. And so I just spent a lot of my time thinking about how do we grow that? Like, how do we help more people earn money on our marketplace? And how do we teach more people stuff on the Tuts network? One day I imagine I'll want to do something other than Envato, and I suspect it will be something like painting or drawing or something in a small room with no people.
So I'd like to maybe just, as we're getting close towards the end of this interview here, for the people who are listening to this, now, I think the biggest takeaway for what you've achieved is the attitude of getting a large company behind what really started as one website and a small group. If we could sort of highlight what you think allowed you to get as big as you did, because I know it'd be difficult where I'm at right now without getting some investment money and then getting a second website targeting something different to sort of start this path towards getting as large as you have and obviously putting in 15, 16 hour days as well. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, the model you chose, the business model of marketplaces in very, very hot online subjects of design and flash and everything that people need to do what they do online, really, like from a technical standpoint. So that's a huge growing market over the years, right? That's been constantly growing.
And so you can't underestimate how strong the marketplace model is in the internet. I think it's very, I mean, just the number of marketplaces you see appearing in all different sectors, everything from like Airbnb, which, you know, you can think of as a marketplace for vacation rentals, through to the App Store, iTunes and whatnot. They're all marketplaces. It's a very suited model to the internet, I think, connecting people from around the world. And it's one that probably wasn't possible for the internet, certainly not in this model, this form in any case. As you say, it's been growing. We were first to market in a whole number of areas. ThemeForest was the first place for WordPress themes. And WordPress, as you know, has grown enormously. And similarly, in lots of other areas, we managed to be the first and the largest in After Effects templates and print templates and a whole bunch of different spaces. And I think that has been a big part of why the company's been able to grow. So we bootstrapped it, right? Like as you mentioned, one path to growth is using venture capital. And to be honest, we didn't use venture capital, not because that's not a good idea, but just because it didn't even occur to me that we could. Probably, I think I'm very happy with bootstraps. Like, I think if I could go back, I'd probably still do it the same way. But yeah, I think the marketplace model suited bootstrapping as well, because it was a model that had income early on, and that, you know, it wasn't like a Twitter model where you're like, let's grow it really large and hope we can figure out a way to monetize later. The marketplace model is much more first type.
So if there's a person listening to this and they want to replicate your success, you would suggest marketplace model. What else would be like your one or two most important tips?
I think that we were committed to, like, I always like the idea of, I think this is a word, beachheads, right? You know, in like a battle when they need to like take a particular position, they try to establish a beachhead. I assume this comes from World War II when they were invading Europe. They had to capture the beaches, and from that they could capture further inland. From that they could capture even further inland. I always think of business in the same way, at least in bootstrapping, that, you know, you can't just go for everything all at once when you don't have any resources. You have to try to take a foothold and use that to get the next bit. And so if you think about the way that Envato's grown, it's all been in that sense. So we built one thing, used it to get some revenue, took all the money we had and all the revenue we were getting from that one thing, and then used that to get more things, invested all our time, as much time as we had, more time than we probably should have invested, didn't really take any money out, but just kept reinvesting to grow. It was a bit painful and it's risky, but it's not as risky as just, I guess, trying to overextend. So yeah, I think that's probably would be one of the main keys, I suppose, with establishing a beachhead and reinvesting and being trying to be sensible and make sure that it's quite sustainable. So once we'd gotten the company to be self-sufficient, every time we'd have a new business area, I would always work to try to make that one self-sustainable on its own two feet and, you know, try to get revenue into Freelance Switch or build a premium program for Tuts, whatever it was, whatever the case may be, not letting there be any big, although not all of them are completely profitable, but on the whole, try sustainable.
One of the things I notice about the Envato Group websites is design is really top. Like, you have a very nice, elegant, simple design for all your sites. Has that been a specific branding strategy in any kind of way, or just because you like design yourself?
I think I am a web designer, so a lot of the early designs, some of them are from me. And I guess it was some of it's personal taste, but I suppose also as a web designer, I understand that there's a lot of power in good design. Like, it establishes credibility, it positions you in a good way. It tells the user that you're a reputable sort of service. So even though you're small, if you have a great design, you can look a bit bigger. The magical thing about the internet is it's kind of hard to figure out just how big a particular site is. So there's that element of it as well. So as a new blogger, you can kind of quickly establish yourself as, and you know, if you think about Freelance, which we talked about before, that I was making pseudonyms and things. I was interested in trying to look the size that I wanted us to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's unusual, Collis, and counterintuitive to the whole, I want us build a personal brand with a small group of followers who just love what I do, and that's how I have my business, which is kind of like what I've done and a lot of bloggers do. But you've sort of added blogging to a different business model as a way to get an audience, but you still want to have, I guess, a big company brand rather than an individual brand, which is perhaps a completely different way of thinking. And maybe in your case, it's one of the main reasons why you are as big as you are.
Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question, actually. I've never really thought about this as a different way of doing things. I just at that time was like, oh, we know we need to look like this awesome freelance magazine and we should have lots of writers. And
It's just like thinking big. You know, they say it all starts with how you think, right? And if you thought, it sounds like even the way you started this company, $100,000, five people, all in, that's thinking bigger than I'll just, you know, put together a WordPress blog, throw some articles out there and see how I go.
Yeah.
What's different about you? You know, what's wrong with you, guys?
I don't know. I have no idea. Yeah. I mean, early on, before we started Flash Den, I'd written a business plan. It wasn't a very good business plan. I got a business plan book and I read it until I got to the bit about finances, which I didn't manage to make it all the way through that section, but I wrote a little business plan about our marketplaces. And I suppose even from that realized, oh, this is going to be a lot of work. We'll need a lot of, I don't know. I suppose, as you say, maybe it's just thinking big. It wasn't something conscious. I think it was more just a natural way of thinking, I suppose.
Okay. Well, speaking of being conscious, I'm conscious of the time. So you do have to run off about now for something else. I guess the best way to wrap it up for us here, Collis, you have so many websites. I don't know where to direct people to if they want to check out what you do. Like, where do you suggest they go?
The best place to go is Envato.com. You've got links off to the marketplaces and to the Tux Plus network and to AppStorm and Creatica and all our different properties. We're actually in the middle of a redesign, although we've been in this middle of this redesign for about a year and a half. So hopefully by the time people are listening to this, it'll be complete and ready to go.
And even if it's not, you can see all the websites, Envato, Envato.com. That's the parent company behind it all. Collis, thank you. It's a huge story and I'd love to go into every little detail of every single website you built. We'd probably be here for about 5 hours to do that. I'm pretty sure you could do that with me too, because I think you would enjoy talking about that all. So, but I think it's some great takeaways here in how to think big, how to get big, how to choose a good business model and team building, lots of things that you've done that are in hindsight, very smart, perhaps without realizing at the time, I guess. So,
accidental.
Yeah. Any last comments for people listening in?
No, thank you so much for having me. And hopefully another time in the future, we'll do the 5-hour marathon one.
It would be fun to do a follow on, but thank you, Collis, and good luck with the ongoing empire you're building.
Thanks so much.
There you go. My interview with Khalis Tayyid, the co-founder of Envato, which was a re-release from my membership site. So it is not current. Khalis might be very surprised if you go and approach him and tell him there's an interview about him that just came out. He may even forgot he did this interview, but I was very excited to release it to you because I think it's a great little origin story there of what is one of Australia's unicorn success stories, which there are not many today. We certainly hear a lot about Atlassian and Canva. I think they're by far the biggest two. Maybe Afterpay is another one you might have heard of because it was acquired by Square quite recently. And Khalis and Envato and, you know, the team and the family just grew this company privately. So, of course, it doesn't get nearly as much press. In fact, they recently also turned Envato to a certified B Corp, which I did not know much about. I had to do a quick bit of research into what a B Corp is. Some other companies that are also certified B Corps include Kickstarter, Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, and CultureAmp. And essentially, it just means they're realigning their goals to not just be about profit, but also purpose. I think what that purpose is their choice to define it. It's pretty clear with Envato that includes their employees. They're distributing 20% of profits back to their employees. That was about $6,000 each last year in 2020. They have money going to charity. So I can tell the it's not just about squeezing every dollar they can, you know, out of their industry and so on. And yeah, hope you enjoyed that one. Before you go, today's sponsor, have not mentioned that yet. This episode is brought to you by InboxDone.com, a company which provides a virtual executive assistant that specializes in written communication, in particular, managing and replying to your email, your social media messages, anywhere you need superior written communication, and someone who's not overseas cheap labor that might have English as a second language, someone who's actually been trained to replicate you, to learn how to represent you as well as you could in your inbox when replying to your messages. Obviously, to work with someone who takes over something as important as private as your email, there is a careful process to help you delegate to your assistants, your email, and other tasks so you feel comfortable with the process. Not only do InboxDone assistants do your email, they will schedule your calendar. They will also do other executive assistant tasks like data entry, basic research, basically anything technical, especially with the written word that you'd like to delegate to them. You can free up 1 to 3 hours per day, depending on how much time you spend currently writing emails or responding to messages in your social, scheduling your calendar, and all those things that we have to do every day. Get them off your plate. Hand them to an executive virtual assistant from InboxDone and your life will be so much simpler. And just so you know, you actually get two executive assistants. That's one of the special things that makes InboxDone different from other executive assistant and virtual assistant companies online. You, no matter when you sign up, you will get two people, dedicated assistants assigned to you, because if you've ever had an assistant, you probably know this, turnover is a pain when it comes to assistants because, you know, you train them to do so many different things and then they leave you. And then the next person you have to train all over again. By training two people on everything you need help with, even if one leaves, you've got the other one still in place who can train the replacement person, the second person. So it's a very redundant system. If you're interested, if that sounds like something you would like in your business, in your life, if you're a founder, an executive, a manager, an entrepreneur, head to InboxDone.com and book a discovery call today. That's InboxDone.com. Okay, that's it from me for today's episode of Vested Capital. I hope you enjoyed it. My name is Yaro, and I'll speak to you on the very next episode. Bye-bye.